Kagarlitsky, the Marxist sociologist, labor activist, was rearrested the other day. And I think that is a measure of what we're seeing across different cities. So that's always part of a war, the nationalism, the repression. You know, Washington, D.C. is different because suppression happens by seduction, not by force, but in other cities and other capitals. So Putin, I think, isolated. The war is unpopular, increasingly unpopular, Amy, as it is in Ukraine. The mobilization of additional men, and it is men, has provoked great unhappiness, protest in parts of Ukraine and Russia. So there's an alliance around the difficulty of drafting more men, more men. It becomes like a war of attrition where thousands are killed on battlefields that resemble World War I, but with 21st century weapons.
The economy was a major part of Biden's address. He made a pledge to increase taxes on the wealthy and for them to pay their fair share. This is some of what he said.
But here's the deal. The last administration enacted a $2 trillion tax cut, overwhelmingly benefit the top 1%, the very wealthy, the biggest corporation, and exploded the federal deficit. They added more to the national debt than any presidential term in American history. Check the numbers. Folks at home, does anybody really think the tax code is fair? Do you really think the wealthy and big corporations need another $2 trillion tax break?
No!
I sure don't. I'm going to keep fighting like hell to make it fair. Under my plan, nobody earning less than $400,000 a year will pay an additional penny in federal taxes. Nobody, not one penny. And they haven't yet. In fact, the child tax credit I passed during the pandemic cut taxes for millions of working families and cut child poverty in half. Restore that child tax credit. No child should go hungry in this country. The way to make the tax code fair is to make big corporations and the very wealthy begin to pay their fair share. Remember in 2020, 55 of the biggest companies in America made $40 billion and paid zero in federal income tax. Zero. Not anymore. Thanks to the law I wrote and we signed, big companies have to pay a minimum 15%. But that's still less than working people pay in federal taxes. It's time to raise corporate minimum tax to at least 21%. So every big corporation finally begins to pay their fair share. I also want to end tax breaks for big pharma, big oil, private jets, massive executive pay when it's only supposed to be $1 million that could be deducted. They can pay them $20 million if they want, but deduct $1 million. End it now. You know, there are 1,000 billionaires in America. You know what the average federal tax is for those billionaires? No. They're making great sacrifices, 8.2%. That's far less than the vast majority of Americans pay. No billionaire should pay a lower federal tax rate than a teacher, a sanitation worker, or a nurse. I propose a minimum tax for billionaires of 25%, just 25%. You know what that would raise? That would raise $500 billion over the next 10 years.
President Biden's State of the Union. Katrina Vandenhoevel, your response.
This was Joe Biden at his best. And it wasn't just Joe Biden. It's the work of decades of movement activists who, when NAFTA was passed, the trade deal 30 years ago, said this ain't going to be very good for workers. And it decimated deindustrialized cities, towns around this country. And again, it's a measure of the importance of the taking on trickle-down, taking on neoliberal economics, the danger. But it was great. I mean, it was like he's channeling the Roosevelt Institute and Sarah Anderson at IPS, Chuck Collins on inequality. I mean, it's these people's work and people in the streets who have moved a Democratic Party from neoliberal economics to understanding the need to think anew about this economy. The danger, again, is if you don't have a transformative kind of foreign policy, you will end up with military Keynesianism as a policy. And that is vying at the moment with the no trickle down neoliberal end of neoliberal economics, the idea that you juice the economy through arms sales. And this is a, you know, a contest, and it will depend on the decisions made about America's role in the world. But I do think to see Sean O'Fain of UAW, to understand the importance of labor and the history, was really a change. And it needs to be continued through movement activists, through the union movements. And it connects in some ways to uncommitted, because the groups that are forming around the uncommitted movement, and it was exciting to hear that in Hawaii, it reached its highest number. My belief is if it had gone on longer in Michigan, if they had more time, you would have had a higher number for clear reasons, the state of Michigan obviously being an important middle, you know, playing an important role in this movement. So I think there's optimism, but, you know, the old order is disappearing. The new one is not yet born. And where this will move is going to depend on ending wars, on thinking anew about a transformative domestic foreign policy, thinking anew about a constricted establishment foreign policy.
And we're going to talk about Gaza in our next segment. But I want to also continue on the issue of the economy and health care, because Biden talked about proposing and signing, and he said, not one of you Republican buddies voted for it. We finally beat Big Pharma. Instead of paying $400 a month or thereabouts for insulin with diabetes, it'll only cost 10 bucks to make. They only get $35 a month now and still make a healthy profit. And now he said he wants to cap the cost of insulin at $35 a month for every American who needs it, and went on to talk about getting Medicare the power to negotiate lower prices on prescription drugs, just like the VA is able to do for veterans.
Amy, this has been on the agenda for years. It's an obscenity that it is still not moved. Bernie Sanders, who has raised it for years, looked awful happy shaking Biden's hand after the State of the Union, because there were key parts which are part of the Democratic agenda and have been put aside in the context of a neoliberal model. So I think Biden channeling a lot of important progressive ideas is a measure that he can be moved. But we're seeing how rigid, I think rigidity is the right word, again, on the foreign policy issues that capture priorities, capture funding. I mean, it's obscene, the Defense Department budget, which is, you know, larger than 10 other countries' budgets combined, and yet we're still seeking. There should be a similar program as there is with pharma, with the defense industry, the military-industrial complex. Get Bill Hartung on the case to just understand the money that is wasted. There's been no audit of the Pentagon for decades, if ever. So I think these are issues, again, that are comparable and that strengthen the domestic agenda, if instead of captured priorities.
And speaking of health care, in the State of the Union, Biden also focused on reproductive rights, which have become a galvanizing issue for the Democratic Party.
There are state laws banning the freedom to choose, criminalizing doctors, forcing survivors of rape and incest to leave their states to get the treatment they need. Many of you in this chamber and my predecessor are promising to pass a national ban on reproductive freedom. My God, what freedom else would you take away? Look, it's a decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court majority wrote the following, and with all due respect, justices, women are not without electoral power. Electoral or political power. You're about to realize just how much you rely on. Clearly. Clearly. Those bragging about overturning Roe v. Wade have no clue about the power of women, but they found out when reproductive freedom was on the ballot. We won in 2022 and 2020, and we'll win again in 2024. If you, the American people, send me a Congress that supports the right to choose, I promise you, I'll restore Roe v. Wade as the law of the land again.
That was President Biden. And, of course, connecting the issue right in front of the Supreme Court justices of reproductive rights and the overturning of Roe to what happened with the Alabama State Court doing this after the overturning and citing it to try to equate frozen embryos with children and how that's closed the Alabama IVF clinics intra the whole in vitro fertilization in Alabama, though the state has just passed a law to reopen those clinics. Katrina.
You know, Amy, I was going to say that your viewers, if they listeners have not already looked up, it's called 2025. It's a document from the Heritage Foundation and a few other think tanks. And there are sections on reproductive rights, as you can imagine, and not empowering, but restricting and gutting. And I think it's important to look beyond Trump and look at Trumpism and the fact that he is going to stuff his cabinet and his administration with political appointees. Essentially, their plans to gut civil service. It's sort of a version of Steve Bannon's gut the administrative state. So I think in that document, even more clearly than last night, you'll see the difference between the two what might be two administrations. But of course, reproductive rights has emerged as a test case of freedom. And I do wish, you know, President Biden spoke of 1941 as he opened his speech last night, and put it in the context of a war between freedom and authoritarianism, democracy and authoritarianism. In fact, that speech was really about four freedoms: freedom of from want, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, and freedom from fear. And I think that's the animating impulse that guides this country.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, publisher of The Nation magazine. When we come back, we're going to look at what President Biden had to say about Gaza. We'll speak with Palestinian Egyptian American University of Chicago professor Iman Abdelhadi, who gave an alternate SOTU last night called State of Genocide, and Israeli peace activist Netta Haman Mina, whose mother was a hostage in Gaza. Stay with us. Back in 20 seconds. Fearless song, Canción Sin Miedo, by Vivir Cantano and Mon Laferte. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In his address, President Biden talked about Gaza, which has become a key election issue. As they watched, progressive lawmakers Cory Bush, Summer Lee, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American in Congress, held up signs reading, "Lasting ceasefire now," and "Stop sending bombs." Tlaib, Summer, and Bush also donned Palestinian keffiyehs. Separately, many Democratic women wore white in honor of the suffragettes. Today's International Women's Day. This is President Biden.
Israel has a right to go after Hamas. Hamas ended this conflict by releasing hostages, laying down arms, could end it by releasing the hostages, laying down arms, and surrendering those responsible for October 7th. But Israel has a added burden because Hamas hides and operates among the civilian population like cowards. under hospitals, daycare centers, and all the like. Israel also has a fundamental responsibility, though, to protect innocent civilians in Gaza. This war has taken a greater toll on innocent civilians than all previous wars in Gaza combined. More than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of whom are not Hamas. Thousands and thousands of innocents, women and children, girls and boys, also orphaned. Nearly 2 million more Palestinians under bombardment or displacement. Homes destroyed, neighborhoods in rubble, cities in ruin. Families without food, water, medicine. It's heartbreaking. I've been working nonstop to establish an immediate ceasefire that would last for 6 weeks to get all the prisoners released, all the hostages released, to get the hostages home and ease the intolerable and humanitarian crisis and build toward an enduring, something more enduring. The United States has been leading international efforts to get more humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Tonight, I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day.
Ahead of Biden's State of the Union address, hundreds of protesters blockaded roads outside the White House near the Capitol, delaying Biden's speech as they demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Other protests took place nationwide, more expected this weekend in Chicago, where the Democratic National Convention will take place this summer. An anti-war coalition held a 24-hour vigil in the city's Federal Plaza, reading as many names as possible of the more than 30,000 Palestinians killed by Israel's bombing of Gaza. They also host an alternate State of the Union address by our next guest.
Tonight's State of the Union is the state of the genocide because our leaders have followed a familiar playbook, investing in power, money, and blood at the expense of humanity.
We go now to Chicago, where we're joined by Iman Abdelhadi, a Palestinian Egyptian American activist and assistant professor at the University of Chicago, where her work includes studying the politics of Muslim Americans. She supported President Biden in the 2020 presidential election and even drove some of her friends to the polls. Welcome to Democracy Now, Professor Abdelhadi. Your message last night.
Thank you, Amy, for having me. I want to point out that I co-wrote and co-gave this speech with Ari Bloomkatz, who's the editor of In These Times magazine. And our message was that business cannot go on as usual, and we are not going away. This genocide has been going on for 152 days, and it is 100% an American project. It would not be where it is today if the U.S. did not send weapons to Israel, did not lend unconditional support. And so it is disingenuous to put it at the end of the speech as though it were a faraway foreign policy issue and not a core issue that is on Americans' minds.
And your response to this idea of setting up a port, first it was airdropping food, but it's as if it's a natural catastrophe, like an earthquake or a tornado or a hurricane, where you have to ensure that somehow people get food, but it is a U.S. ally who the U.S. is arming, Israel.
Yeah, the President Biden is effectively holding a gun to Palestinians' heads and shooting at them with one hand and throwing crumbs at them with the other hand. And he wants us as American people to focus only on the crumbs that he's throwing. Meanwhile, we are saying and have been saying, President Biden, drop the gun. It is absurd to frame these deaths as though they are just collateral damage and not an intentional strategy of ethnic cleansing by the Israeli state.
I wanted to bring in Neda Haman-Mina, who is a member of the Israeli chapter of Women Wage Peace. Her 84-year-old mother, Ditsa Haman, was taken hostage by Hamas from her home on the kibbutz near Oz, near the border with Gaza, but was released on November 28th. She's joining us from Israel. Netta, thanks so much for being with us, coming back on Democracy Now! There were a number of hostage families represented last night who were guests of Congress members, of the Bidens, of the Israeli-American or American hostages in Gaza. First of all, how is your mother? And can you talk about what you want to see happen now?
Hi, thank you for having me. My mother is okay. She is starting to live her new life. She can't go back to her home in the kibbutz because the kibbutz is wounded by the Hamas. But she's still waiting for her neighbors and the friends from the kibbutz that are still there. There are still 37 live hostages from Kibbutz Nir Oz still in Gaza. I think we need to do everything we can to bring them back, even if it said ceasefire, even if it said release the Palestinian prisoners. We must do it as soon as possible because they don't have time. They can't stay there. It's a, you see, I was in some event today, and this is the number of days they are there. And there are old people and children and women that we heard hear what they are going through. The old people doesn't get their medications. It needs to be as soon as possible.
And can you talk about the movement that has been formed by the hostage families? I don't think their message comes through as clearly in the United States. We have interviewed a number of people, of those Israelis who were killed on October 7th, like Chaim Weizmann, who was a student at University of Washington. We talked to his sibling, Noy Weizmann, in Brussels, who said, "My brother would not want this killing to continue in Gaza." If you can talk about what hostages' families are saying right now and how a number of them, well, like you, you're the daughter, you're with Women Wage Peace, a number of those even taken or who died were peace activists.
I don't want to talk in the name of all the families, the hostage families, because we have different thoughts about the situation. But I think the majority want to do everything to bring them back. And they don't care if we need to stop the war now or release the Palestinians hostages. They are Palestinians prisoners. Sorry. I think the majority want to do and everything to bring them back. We talked 2 weeks ago with people from the there was people that understand, and they told us that Israel can manage. We stop the war now and can manage with the release of the prisoners. And there is no problem to do it.
Let me bring back Professor Iman Abdelhadi. Can you talk about what Netanyahu is threatening, the land invasion of Rafah, what that would mean?
It would mean the complete ethnic cleansing of the rest of the Gaza Strip. We've seen 1.5 million people squeezed into this tiny piece of land. And now that last refuge, that last piece of land that was supposed to be safe, would be under attack. Palestinians literally have nowhere left to go. ultimately, this is a continuation of the policy that Netanyahu has been following since October, right? And since before October, in fact. He and other officials from his administration have been very open in declaring their intent to clear Gaza, to basically empty it of its inhabitants and ready it for settlement. And yet they have faced no consequences from the Biden administration. Your guest before said that we need a transformative foreign policy. And yet what we're seeing is that the American ruling class is unwilling to transform the relationship of unconditional support to Israel.
And Iman, what are the plans for the Democratic Convention in Chicago, where you are?
Well, you know, we are very unhappy with this administration. I think the Uncommitted campaign shows this. Chicago has the largest Palestinian community in the country. It's in fact one of the largest Palestinian diaspora communities in the world. And we are not going away. We are still going to be in the streets, and we are going to make sure that the DNC knows where we stand on this issue.
And let me ask Neda Haman-Mina. I'm wondering if you can talk about what's happening with the government right now, that Netanyahu, to say the least, has a conflict of interest. If he is forced out of government, he could end up in prison. You now have Benny Gantz meeting with Vice President Harris and Tony Blinken in Washington, D.C., part of the War Cabinet, former defense minister. Do you see the government falling apart?
I don't know if the government will fall apart, but I want first say, before I answer your question, that we need to remember that the Hamas started this attack. At the 7th of October, Hamas attacked Israel, killed 1,400 people, take 254 hostages from their beds with their pajamas. We need to remember this and the situation in Gaza now. It's as well as the Hamas make it. Hamas doesn't care the Israeli people, and he doesn't care the Gaza people. I think he cared the Gaza people less than the Israeli care, and for sure less the American care. I don't know if the government will fall apart. There is a problem. Our prime minister, bringing back the hostages, is not in his first priority. His first priority is to stay prime minister, and that the government won't fall apart. And he has a very difficult situation with Ben Gvir and Smotrich, that if it will be a deal that said that we need to stop the war and to release the Palestinian prisoner, he will have a problem with his government.
Let me go to Iman Abdelhadi. If you can respond to what Neda has said. And also, we just got this news, according to CBS News 5, people were killed Friday by an airdrop package that when at least one parachute failed to properly deploy and the parcel fell on them. The video is circulating now. We have just 30 seconds.
Hamas was reacting to a 16-year siege. I'm not promoting what they did on October 7th, but to say that this whole issue started on October 7th is to ignore the fact that a Palestinian was killed every single day in 2023 leading up to October 7th. So without addressing the root causes of October 7th, without addressing the violence of keeping 2 million people under siege for 17 years without freedom of movement,
10 seconds.
Then we're not going to get anywhere.
Iman Abdelhadi, I want to thank you for being with us, assistant professor at the University of Chicago, Palestinian Egyptian American, and Israeli Neda Haman-Mina, member of the Israeli chapter of Women Wage Peace. Her mother was just freed from Gaza in November.
The FCAT After School Podcast is back for its third season.
Starting January 10th, you'll hear interviews and profiles from Simon Fraser University's Faculty of Communication, Art, and Technology alumni with lives lived and stories to tell.
Subscribe to the FCAT After School Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be sending a new episode down your feed every other Wednesday starting January 10th.
Or catch us on 90.1 FM CJSF every Tuesday at 4 p.m. starting January 16th.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Radio Rewind.